Tragically, Genesis tells us that when man was first presented with the opportunity to choose for Christ, he chose instead for himself. He convinced himself that the purpose of life was pleasure. As a result of such rebellion, man and all nature were thrown into confusion. Disease and afflictions of every kind were unleashed upon the earth. By allowing such troubles, Jesus hoped that man, in desperation, might look to him for deliverance. Yet Christ did not leave the problem of salvation up to man. He planned to actually come down to the earth and bring salvation. The penalty for rebellion against Almighty God is eternal torment in hell. Yet Christ intended to die in our place, bearing punishment for all who would trust in him. As a result of man's rejection of his Creator, the world languished in violence and superstition. How could Christ begin to prepare the world for his eventual coming?
He put his moral light within a special tribe of people. They would have the privilege and responsibility of keeping truth alive and making a place for Christ when he came.
To gradually instruct his people, the Israelites, Christ gave them many laws and ceremonies. These were to help them understand the difference between what is right and wrong, sacred and profane. Christ expected every Israelite to give him not just works of the law, but sincere love, trust, and loyalty. His great commandment to them was that they love him with all their heart, soul, and mind. Christ's requirement of obedient faith from Jews all the days of their lives is the same demand he makes of us today. It never changes. In the 16th chapter of Ezekiel, God's chosen tribe, Israel, is portrayed in an amazing relationship with her Creator. She is Jehovah's unique bride among the nations. We are told that Jehovah, who is actually Jesus, chose Israel alone among the nations to become his spiritual wife, to have spiritual relations with him. Yet this passage goes on to describe how Israel prostituted that relationship. She became a spiritual harlot by worshiping other gods. In no less than 86 clear passages in the Old Testament, Israel is pointedly described as a whore. In fact, having been the first to marry God, she became the mother of spiritual harlots. Although many religious systems throughout history have turned their backs on Christ to become spiritual harlots, only apostate Israel is the mother of the principle of spiritual whoredom. Only apostate Israel has mother of harlots branded on her forehead forever.
Throughout the Old Testament period, Christ tried to persuade his harlot bride to return to him. Finally, he came to earth in one last effort to reconcile her. Her response? She had him crucified. So ended the marriage of Christ to Israel. He divorced her and chose a bride composed of believing Jews and Gentiles. After the mother of harlots was divorced from her husband, she became enraged at his new bride, the early church. The book of Acts tells how Jews ruthlessly persecuted and attempted to destroy the church. Yet soon after rebelling against Rome, first in 70 AD, then in 132 AD, the harlot herself was persecuted by the Romans and cast out of her promised land. For the next 1,000 years, Jews dwelt in Babylon, absorbing its witchcraft and occultry. In fact, no other nation except the modern Iraqis have lived longer in Babylon than the harlot Israel. From the exile of Nebuchadnezzar in 586 BC to their expulsion from Babylon in the 11th century AD, the majority of Jews lived in Babylon for 1,600 years, longer than they had lived in Palestine. In Babylon, the Pharisees, who had become the uncontested spiritual leaders of the Jews, incorporated many Babylonian perversions into their new anti-Bible, the Babylonian Talmud. In the Talmud, the mother of harlots turned upside down literally everything her ex-husband Jesus had taught her. In the book of Deuteronomy, God warns the Hebrews that if they rejected him, they would become cursed above all nations. Eventually, they not only rejected his law, but crucified the giver of that law. As a result, the Jewish people have been led into a dark and waterless pit of spiritual confusion called the Talmud. For the last 2,000 years, there they have remained under the spiritual authority of the Pharisees, those who masterminded the death of Jesus. 2 millennia of such spiritual darkness is proof that the ancient curse in Deuteronomy still lies heavily on the Jews.
In my book, Israel, Our Duty, Our Dilemma, I detail how Judaism was corrupted by the occult and immoral practices of Babylon. Let's touch very briefly on just one aspect of such depravity, pederasty, or the sexual molestation of children. Today, the greatest rabbis of the Talmud would be locked up as child molesters. Pederasty was deeply entrenched among the most respected Talmudic rabbis. It was taken for granted that the local rabbi could acquire a baby girl at 3 years of age as his sex toy simply by raping her. Here are several passages from many in the Talmud granting such permission. In Nida 45b, a woman asks, "Master, at what age may a woman marry?" "At the age of 3 years and 1 day," he told her. "A girl of 3 years and 1 day may be betrothed by intercourse." Rabbi Joseph said, "Come and hear. A maiden of 3 years old and a day may be acquired in marriage by coition." When a grown-up man has intercourse with a little girl, it is nothing. The footnote to this passage says, "Tears come to the eye again and again. So does virginity come back to the little girl under 3 years." Although the Talmud forbids homosexuality among adult Jews, sodomy with small boys is permitted. Leviticus 20:13 forbids sexual relations between men. The Talmud, however, defines a boy under 9 years of age as a minor, not a man. He is excluded from the biblical prohibition. Since the boy is not sexually mature, the Talmud teaches, he cannot throw guilt upon the rabbi who rapes him. Only he who is able to engage in sexual intercourse may throw guilt upon the active offender, whilst he who is unable to engage in sexual intercourse cannot.
It is significant that the pederasty we have mentioned is endorsed by the very greatest rabbis of the Talmud. These include Rabbi Ben Zakkai, Rabbi Ben Yochai, and Rabbi Akiba. Christ accused the Pharisees of all uncleanness. This may have included child sex.
It is because of such unbelievable darkness and immorality, largely absorbed from 1600 years in Babylon, that the book of Revelation gave a new name to the harlot of the Old Testament. She is now called Babylon the Great, mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Her chief city, Jerusalem, is also referred to from heaven, not as Jerusalem, but as Sodom and Egypt, a term denoting sexual vice and bondage. In the 11th century AD, the inhabitants of Babylon expelled the Jews once again. The mother of harlots, Israel, was forced to wander among the nations. After the harlot was expelled from Babylon, she was forced to enter the Western and ultimately the modern world. Yet she was full of purpose and revenge. Before her rebellion, she possessed the respectability of a married woman with a lavish house and city to dwell in. Yet now, having been cast out, she vowed she would return to her house and lands, her temple and capital city, Jerusalem. Once secure in her land, she would find another husband who hated Jesus as much as she did. Together, they would mock Jesus by ruling the world from Jerusalem. With this great and sinister goal in mind, the harlot conceived an intricate and very long-range plan to corrupt Christ's new bride, the church, and weaken the nations. She planned to so deceive and corrupt humanity that ultimately she and her false husband might assume control of the nations. During this medieval period, mystical rabbis, children of the harlot, perfectly expressed their mother's plan for world dominion. They recorded her intentions in the Zohar, also called Kabbalah. Today, religious Jews consider the Zohar to be as inspired as the Talmud. Most ultra-Orthodox Jews consider it even more inspired. Quoting the Zohar, Rabbi Yehuda said to him, Rabbi Chizkiah, "He is to be praised who is able to free himself from the enemies of Israel, and the just are much to be praised to get free from them and fight against them." Rabbi Chizkiah asked, "How must we fight against them?" Rabbi Yehuda said, "By wise counsel thou shalt war against them." "By what kind of war?" "The kind of war that every son of man must war against his enemies, which Jacob used against Esau, by deceit and trickery wherever possible. They must be fought against without ceasing until proper order be restored. Thus it is with satisfaction that I say we should free ourselves from them and rule over them." Because the harlot's children were gifted merchants, she sent them forth as moneylenders. During the Middle Ages and Renaissance, her children became usurers, not only to the people of Europe, but to kings. As a result, she gained fabulous wealth. She created a network of banking houses, including the Rothschilds, Warburgs, and Schiffs. The eminent British historian Nesta Webster, in her many books, which were publicly praised by Winston Churchill, described how Jews made use of secret societies. Freemasonry and the Illuminati were secret, yet incredibly organized anti-Christian organizations attempting to subvert Christian society. Through incredible organization and intrigue, they sought to establish their own New World Order. Although primarily composed of Gentiles, Jewish agents of the harlot were able to manipulate these secret societies to the harlot's own ends. With the assistance of Freemasonry and the Illuminati, the harlot's children sowed discord. This not only helped bring down the French monarchy, but largely destroyed the power of the Catholic Church in France. In 1785 in Germany, a courier for the Bavarian Illuminati was killed when a lightning bolt struck him. When local police went through his bags, they found incredibly detailed evidence of how the Illuminati had infiltrated all German universities during the latter 18th century. Through invention of so-called higher criticism of the Bible, the Illuminati eroded faith in the land of Luther. This paved the way for the rise of Hegel, Nietzsche, and Nazism. But it was through communism that the harlot most impacted the modern world. Jewish revolutionaries masterminded and led the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. Such Jewish overthrow of the Tsar and conquest of Russia was funded by the Jewish banking house of Kuhn Loeb in New York and by the Rothschilds and Warburgs in Europe. The Encyclopedia Judaica tells us the communist movement and ideology played an important part in Jewish life. Individual Jews played an important role in the early stages of Bolshevism and the Soviet regime. The great attraction of communism among Russian and later also Western Jewry emerged only with the establishment of the Soviet regime in Russia. Communism and support of the Soviet Union thus seemed to many Jews to be the only alternative, and communist trends became widespread in virtually all Jewish communities. During this period, intelligence services of the Western powers were abuzz with reports of Jewish control of the Bolshevik Revolution. American intelligence from Siberia reported that of 384 commissars, more than 300 were Jews. The Bolshevik movement is and has been, since its beginning, guided and controlled by Russian Jews. Jews predominate in local Soviet government. Anti-Jewish feeling growing among population. 50% of Soviet government in each town consists of Jews. British intelligence reveals the same pattern. There is now definite evidence that Bolshevism is an international movement controlled by Jews. Bolshevik leaders did not represent Russian working classes, most of them being Jews. And Dutch intelligence. Bolshevism is organized and worked by Jews who have no nationality and whose one object is to destroy for their own ends the existing order of things. Here is a photo of the First People's Commissariat. From left to right are Yuritsky, Trotsky, Zinoviev, Sverdlov, Kaganovich, all Jewish. Sir Winston Churchill, writing in the Illustrated Sunday Herald of February 8, 1920, sums up the Jewish creation of communism. There is no need to exaggerate the part played in the creation of Bolshevism and in the actual bringing about of the Russian Revolution by these international and, for the most part, atheistical Jews. It is certainly a very great one. With the notable exception of Lenin, the majority of the leading figures are Jews. Quoting the American Hebrew of September 8, 1920, "The Bolshevist Revolution in Russia was the work of Jewish brains, of Jewish dissatisfaction, of Jewish planning, whose goal is to create a new order in the world. What was performed in so excellent a way in Russia, thanks to Jewish brains and because of Jewish dissatisfaction, and by Jewish planning, shall also become a reality all over the world." As a result, in Russia and China alone, not to mention such communist countries as Cuba and Cambodia, at least 186 million people were killed, millions of whom were Christians. The great harlot has become drunk with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. In the years that followed the Bolshevik victory, through all forms of liberalism, socialism, and Marxism, the children of the great harlot worked feverishly to break down faith in Jesus Christ and the moral values he taught. That is why almost all assaults against Christian activities and symbols in the 20th century, in both schools and public places, are spearheaded by such Jewish civil liberties organizations as the American Civil Liberties Union, People for the American Way, and the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. For example, the primary opponent of Judge Roy Moore in his defense of the Ten Commandments is Jewish lawyer Morris Dees and his Southern Poverty Law Center. In the same way, so-called anti-hate laws have been pioneered, both in the U.S. and Canada, by the Jewish Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. These are really anti-Christian laws ending free speech. In Canada, the Canadian Jewish Congress recently pushed through Parliament its new anti-hate bill, C-300. C-300 makes it a criminal offense to publicly use the Bible to argue against homosexuality. Penalty for violation is 5 years in prison. In America also, the ADL's monster anti-hate bill, the Local Law Enforcement Enhancement Act, awaits passage by Congress. It would establish a vast federal anti-hate bureaucracy similar to Canada's. Such Jewish victories are possible because the mother of harlots is in media control of the nations. Here's how the great harlot has acquired such staggering power.
As the 20th century dawned, countless immigrants fled political, religious, and economic oppression in Europe. Those numbers included millions of Jews, mostly from Eastern Europe. Not fluent in the English language, such Jews, like other immigrants, found it difficult to penetrate the economic and cultural life of America. However, the invention of the silent movie by Thomas Edison provided Jewish immigrants with the opportunity to enter a new enterprise not dependent upon language skills or dominated by large capital and established interests. They began by showing silent movies in shabby little movie theaters, especially in the poor immigrant quarters. Since immigrants did not have to understand English, silent movies were immensely popular. Soon some Jewish theater owners began distributing films as well as buying other theaters. Their earnings enabled them to enter the field of film production, migrating from the East Coast to sunny Southern California. Many former owners of rundown movie theaters found themselves the heads of large Hollywood film companies. The first of the Hollywood film giants to emerge was Paramount, founded and managed by former Jewish theater owner Adolf Zukor. Paramount quickly dominated film production and distribution by its insistence that local theaters rent only Paramount's films. One Jewish producer who tried to fight Paramount's monopoly was Carl Lemmel. In 1912, he founded what ultimately became Universal Studios. William Fox, another Jew, founded what later became 20th Century Fox. At nearly the same time, Louis B. Mayer, owner of a chain of movie theaters on the East Coast, founded what became Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. With the advent of talking pictures, the other companies, founded and headed by Jews, rose to greatness. Columbia was owned and dominated by Harry Cohn. Warner Brothers was founded by Jack, Harry, Sam, and Albert Warner. As the prestigious Encyclopedia Judaica tells us, thus all the large Hollywood companies, with the exception of United Artists, were founded and controlled by Jews. In its article on television and radio, the Judaica is also quick to give Jews credit for the development of radio and television. It says that David Sarnoff started the first U.S. radio chain, the National Broadcasting Company, in 1926 as a service of RCA. He developed RCA into an electronic giant. Sarnoff also pioneered the development of color television, building NBC into one of the big three TV networks. In 1925, the Judaica tells us, CBS Radio was founded by another Jew, William S. Paley, a Chicago cigar maker. Paley bought up an unsuccessful chain of Eastern U.S. radio stations. Through his long lifetime, he built CBS into a multi-billion dollar television empire. The third major television network, ABC, the Judaica says, was an outgrowth of an antitrust suit against NBC in the early 1940s. Leonard Goldenson became its president as it soared to similar domination of national television. Yet who owns the big three today? Today, Sarnoff's NBC is owned by General Electric Corporation, yet it is still run primarily by Jews. The president of NBC News, Andrew Lack, is Jewish, as is Senior Vice President of Operations and Planning, Jay Fine, Vice President of Program Development, Jeffrey Gaspin, and Vice President Vera Mayer are also Jewish. This confirms the famous Lichter-Rothman poll of top media executives, which found that 59% are Jewish. Today, William Paley's CBS is owned by another Jew, Sumner Redstone, whose original name was Murray Rothstein. Sumner Redstone also owns Viacom, the producer and distributor of TV shows for all three networks. Viacom is the largest provider of cable TV programming, owning such cable giants as Showtime, MTV, and Nickelodeon. MTV is the dominant cultural influence on teens and youth in their 20s in the world today. In addition to owning Paramount Studios, Sumner Redstone also owns a New York publishing empire, which includes Simon & Schuster. Leonard Goldenson's ABC network is now owned by Michael Eisner. The owner of Disney and a pro-homosexual Jew, Eisner owns ESPN Cable and Miramax Movie Studios, making his media empire the second largest in the nation. After acquiring Disney, Eisner, like the other Jewish media moguls we have mentioned, has pursued a policy of replacing Gentiles with Jews in leadership positions. The biggest media leviathan in the world today is AOL Time Warner. until its merger with internet provider AOL, Time Warner, controlled by Gerald Levin, a Jew, was the second largest communications empire in America. Levin bought Turner Broadcasting in 1996 and appointed Jewish executive Walter Isaacson as head of the CNN News Group. Time Warner owns HBO, the country's largest pay TV cable record company, as well as Warner Brothers Studios. Time Warner's publishing empire is headed by chief editor Norman Perlstein. In 2000, Time Warner was bought by internet provider AOL, headed by Gentile Steve Case. Case was chairman of this new mega media empire, while Gerald Levin was CEO. Recently, however, possibly because of financial mismanagement, both Case and Levin have been forced to step down. Levin's African-American appointee, Richard Parsons, is now in control. Not far behind is the media empire of Edgar Bronfman II, Jewish heir of the Seagram's distillery fortune. He owns the biggest record business in the world, PolyGram, as well as Universal Studios and the legendary Jewish media giant MCA. Nicknamed the Octopus for the extent of its power in the communications and recording industries, MCA is best known for its production of the blasphemous movie The Last Temptation of Christ. Rupert Murdoch, owner of the News Corporation and Fox Television Network, while not Jewish, is strongly pro-Israel. His president and CEO of the Fox Group, Peter Chernin, is Jewish. The Los Angeles Jewish Times confirms our summary. Four of the largest five entertainment giants are now run or owned by Jews. Murdoch's News Corporation, at number four, is the only Gentile holdout. However, Rupert is as pro-Israel as any Jew, probably more so. Canada's largest media conglomerate is Canwest Global, owned by Jewish media mogul Israel Asper. Asper rules his media empire of 17 Canadian daily newspapers and over 100 weeklies, plus radio and TV stations, with an iron hand. He forbids criticism of Israel. Today, even though ownership of communication networks may change hands, Jews continue to direct and staff the media. Their power and presence only increases. The Encyclopedia Judaica, in its article on publishing, also reveals that a preponderance of U.S. daily newspapers and most New York publishing houses are Jewish-owned. These include the three most influential newspapers in America. First is the New York Times, including its New York Times Book Review, the standard guide to bookstore and library purchasing. Second is the newspaper most influential upon lawmakers on Capitol Hill, The Washington Post. The Washington Post also publishes the International Herald Tribune, the most widely distributed newspaper in the English language. Third in influence is the Wall Street Journal, with its daily circulation of 4 million. Such staggering power over the printed page does not include the literally hundreds of newspapers throughout the nation that are owned by Jews. Such power begins with the New York Daily News, the Village Voice, the New York Post, and spreading out through the vast publishing empire of the Samuel Newhouse chain of 30 daily newspapers. Newhouse also owns Parade magazine with its circulation of 22 million. Jewish control of the newspaper industry constitutes a complex web of Jewish media interconnection. Until Gerald Levin recently stepped down from control of AOL Time Warner, Jews had dominated the three most influential news magazines in America: Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News and World Report. Mortimer Zuckerman, owner and editor-in-chief of U.S. News and World Report, also owns Atlantic Monthly and the New York Daily News. The Encyclopedia Judaica, in its article on publishing, confirms that two of the three largest book publishers, Simon & Schuster and Random House, have during the 20th century been Jewish-owned. Only very recently has Random House become a subsidiary of the German media giant Bartelmans AG. The third, AOL Time Warner, while no longer under the direct control of Gerald Levin, remains under powerful Jewish influence. A half dozen Jewish publishers and distributors also control distribution of 95% of best-selling books.
The Book of Revelation describes the mother of harlots in commercial and media control of the world. It says the harlot sits on many waters, which it clarifies to be peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. In other words, the harlot sits in control of what information is fed to the unstable passions of humanity. Two 2,000 years ago, Jesus, in the book of Revelation, informed his bride, the church, of how the great city, Babylon the Great, would come against the church in the last days. He said the harlot would be ruling the world through exactly the kind of commercialism and control we have been talking about. She would be drunk with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, causing the nations to become corrupt and drunk with the wine of her spiritual whoredom. Increasingly, we see this fulfilled as the Jewish TV and movie media press the wine of profanity, sex, and violence to the lips of an unsuspecting Gentile world. Almost effortlessly, it seems, the Jewish media, especially since the 60s, has transformed America from a nation respecting the institution of marriage into one in which fornication, living together, and homosexuality have become acceptable sexual alternatives.
The prophet Isaiah foretold that the Antichrist would gather the whole world to himself as one might gather a clutch of abandoned eggs. No one would protest. Incredibly, the church, while very aware of the moral corruption of America by the media, is oblivious to its Jewish source. Living in the midst of the greatest fulfillment of biblical prophecy in the last 2,000 years, the church is utterly unaware that Babylon is now. Babylon is corrupting our children, destroying our nation and values, and Babylon is Jewish. The Bible warns us that such blindness in the last days results from the harlot's ability as a sorceress to deceive the nations and the church. Jesus warned that so pervasive would be deception in the last days that if it were possible, even his very elect would be deceived.
To make matters worse, the harlot, while distracting the church away from investigation of her true and secret beliefs, has encouraged an idealistic conception of who and what Israel is. She asserts that her counterfeit return to Palestine is under God's special blessing, fulfilling hundreds of Old Testament prophecies. Today, the harlot emphasizes that far from being under God's ancient curse of Deuteronomy, Israel is so sacred in God's eyes that to criticize her is to bring God's wrath upon oneself and nation.
Distracted from recognition of Babylon's true identity, the church, since the time of Martin Luther, has believed that Rome in Italy is the harlot of Revelation. In Revelation 17, we are told the great harlot sits on seven mountains. Ever since the Reformation in the 16th century, Protestantism has identified these as the seven legendary hills of Rome. Yet in reality, there are more hills than seven surrounding Rome. On the other hand, schoolchildren in Israel have been taught to memorize seven actual hills surrounding Jerusalem. These are Mount of Olives, Mount Scopus, Golgotha, Hill of Offense, Mount Zion, Mount Moriah, and Mount Herzl.
Although the harlot was exiled in humiliation from her land 1900 years ago, her great dream has always been to return and reoccupy her land and capital city. This she did in the 20th century, mercilessly mistreating the Arab inhabitants and provoking a backlash of international Arab terrorism. But her ambitions in the Middle East have only begun. 2,500 years ago, the prophet Ezekiel, in Ezekiel 38 and 39, vividly saw how Israel would again in the last days return to the land. Yet it would occur in such wickedness that God in Ezekiel 39:23 tells us he will be hiding his face from Israel. God says in Ezekiel 43:7 that Israel will be just as much of a harlot as she was in the Old Testament. This proves that the Bible still views Israel today as the mother of harlots. During this false return, which was begun in our time, Ezekiel says the harlot will have achieved such power that she can dwell without bars or gates, in peace and safety. No one will dare come against her.
This prophesied place of dominion over the nations is what the harlot eagerly seeks today. Such dominance is tantalizingly close to fulfillment. It is especially close now that the United States is lending the full force of its military might to the task of subduing Israel's Mideast enemies. President Bush is boldly sending the message to the remainder of Israel's adversaries to expect to be invaded if they militarily oppose Israel. The Allies, after World War II, forced Germany to ban skepticism concerning the Holocaust. So in the years ahead, we may well see the elimination of free speech in the Middle East.
With completion of Israel's fence of partition, Israel may soon be able to expel all Arabs from Israel proper. With Muslims denied access to the Dome of the Rock, Israel may be able to destroy or remove it, allowing construction of her own long-awaited temple.
Tomorrow, the great harlot will indeed subdue not only the Middle East, but the whole world. Revelation 17 and 18 vividly describes Babylon the Great, mother of harlots, ruling over the kings of the nations in a worldwide commercial empire centering in Jerusalem.
The Talmud provides a frightening scenario of events leading up to Jewish world conquest. For the past 2,000 years, the Talmud has been the greatest legal and spiritual authority for religious Jews, far surpassing the Bible. For this reason, we must take very seriously the following definitive statement from the Talmud. It is the premise upon which Judaism's dreams of world control are established. The Talmud says in Sanhedrin 98b that God is very angry that his people, the Jews, have been persecuted. The Almighty himself bewails Israel in the power of the Gentile. God wants to destroy the Gentiles to avenge the wrongs suffered by the Jews. God then asks, "These the Gentiles are my handiwork, and so are these the Jews. How shall I destroy the former?" Footnotes explain the Talmud's answer. The Israelites, having fallen, were replaced in power by the Gentiles. But on their recovery, it will be difficult to remove the Gentiles without inflicting much suffering. These troubles are generally referred to as birth pangs, being the travail which precedes the birth of a new era. The Talmud predicts that Messiah will come when darkness covers these people, meaning Gentiles and Christians. This is clarified by the footnote to Sanhedrin 99a. Thus Israel should hope for redemption because it will be a day of light to them. But why should the Gentiles, seeing that for them it will be a day of darkness? Is God entirely responsible for inflicting this suffering on Gentiles? Or does God make use of Jews to carry out his will? A cardinal tenet of Judaism is that the Jewish people are the practical, visible expression of God's will on earth, his tools toward returning the whole world to Judaic monotheism. The Talmud's encouragement also explains why Jewish media moguls are so brazen in pushing immorality and even sodomy down the throat of Christian America. They have a Talmudic duty to cooperate with God, a God who wills a time of intense confusion and immorality. Only by the collapse of Christian civilization can a better civilization follow, a Jewish kingdom of God on earth. As we have seen, when the greatest rabbis of the Talmud consider the raping and sodomizing of little girls and boys to be normal, it is little wonder that such perverse moral attitudes filter into the content of the Jewish film industry. The Zohar, or Kabbalah, like the Talmud, is also considered to be divinely inspired by religious Jews. It says that when God will reveal himself preceding the coming of Messiah, the Gentiles will be wiped off the earth. Redemption will not be complete until Amalek, or Gentiles, will be exterminated. When these shall be exterminated, it will be as if God had made heaven and earth on that day. But before these are exterminated, the rain of the Torah will not descend, and Israel, who are compared to herbs and trees, cannot shoot up. Gentiles, the Zohar states, are not men, but beasts of the earth. At that time, man, meaning the Jews, should be unique in the world and ruler over all. Persecution is part of the suffering which those who criticize Israel must expect before the coming of Israel's golden age. In a sermon preached by Rabbi Leon Spitz during Purim observances, he said, "The Purim Jews stood up for their lives. American Jews, too, must come to grips with our contemporary anti-Semites. We must fill our jails with anti-Semitic gangsters. We must fill our insane asylums with anti-Semitic lunatics. We must harass and prosecute our Jew-baiters to the extreme limits of the law." A fascinating book entitled The Jewish Utopia, describing Jewish world rulership, was written by Jewish author Dr. Michael Higger. It was presented by the CALA, or Council of Texas Rabbis, to the Abraham Schechter Collection at the University of Texas. It was endorsed by the founder of Conservative Judaism, Abraham Schechter. This book agrees with the Talmud that the advent of the ideal era will thus be preceded by the travail of the Messianic time, namely great distress, foreign invasions, confusion, and moral decline. Following that, the people of Israel will thus conquer spiritually the nations of the earth, so that Israel will be made high above all nations, in praise, in name, and in glory. Behind the whitened facade of such so-called spiritual conquest will be a sword dripping with the blood of the nations. In general, the peoples of the world will be divided into two main groups, the Israelitic and the non-Israelitic. The former will be righteous. They will live in accordance with the wishes of one universal God. All the other peoples, on the other hand, will be known for their detestable practices, idolatry, and similar acts of wickedness. They will be destroyed and will disappear from earth before the ushering in of the ideal era. While Dr. Higger concedes that Gentiles who convert to Judaism may survive, his book is very specific as to which Gentiles must die. Israel will be a living testimony to the absolute unity of God. Consequently, in the ideal era, there will be no people who will believe in the division of the Godhead with two or more parts or persons. Only those people who believe in one God will survive in the ideal world. Jewish world government thus means death to anyone who believes in the Trinity, meaning Christians. This will be the great age of Christian martyrs, when, as Christ predicted, Christians will be delivered up to Jewish synagogues and condemned to death. Babylon the Great will be drunken with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. In 1949, Israel's Prime Minister, David Ben-Gurion, confirmed the Talmud's dream of a Jewish utopia. Jerusalem is not the capital of Israel and world Jewry. It aspires to become the spiritual center of the world. In a 1962 Look magazine article, Ben-Gurion became much more specific. All continents will become unified in a world alliance, at whose disposal will be an international police force. All armies will be abolished, and there will be no more war. In Jerusalem, the United Nations, a truly United Nations, will build a shrine of the prophets to serve the federated union of all continents. This will be the seat of the Supreme Court of Mankind to settle all controversies among the federated continents, as prophesied by Isaiah. Here are some of many admissions by Jewish leaders over the years, confirming the Talmudic dream of world control.
Max Mandelstam at the World Zionist Congress, 1898. The Jews energetically reject the idea of fusion with the other nationalities and cling to their historical hope of world empire. Morris A. Levy, Secretary, World League of Liberal Jews, 1946. The only true path to follow to gain real peace and honest government is through Judaism, and the Jewish people can and will lead the people to lasting peace. The promise of Jehovah for the Jewish people to rule the world and for the Jews to hold high places in world government has arrived. Menachem Begin at a Tel Aviv conference, 1956. You shall have no pity on them until we shall have destroyed their so-called Arab culture, on the ruins of which we shall build our own civilization. Dr. Nahum Goldman, President, World Zionist Congress, 1960. The Jews might have had Uganda, Madagascar, and other places for the establishment of a Jewish fatherland, but they want absolutely nothing but Palestine, because Palestine constitutes the veritable center of world political power, the strategic military center for world control. Rabbi Meir Kahane, 1973. The Jewish people cannot ever be destroyed, but rather they and their God of history will emerge in days to come, triumphant over the evils and the foolishness of all other nations. Zion will and must emerge as the mount to which all other peoples turn.
Sir Winston Churchill, not a Jew but an illustrious Gentile, provides one of the most telling prophecies concerning Jewish world dominion. It may be that this same astounding race may at the present time be in the actual process of producing another system of morals and philosophy as malevolent as Christianity was benevolent, which, if not arrested, would shatter irretrievably all that Christianity had rendered possible. It would almost seem as if the gospel of Christ and the gospel of Antichrist were destined to originate among the same people. When the harlot is finally able to subdue all who come against her, she can satisfy her ancient lust for revenge. Although she was frustrated in her attempts to destroy the infant church in the book of Acts, Revelation tells us someday she will finish what she started 2,000 years ago. The harlot will terribly persecute the church. She will be drunk with the blood of the saints. Her civil liberties organizations, such as the Anti-Defamation League, the American Civil Liberties Union, and People for the American Way, have long conditioned the world to believe that criticism of Jews is anti-Semitism, a form of hate.
Under Israel's new world order, Christian pastors will be jailed as haters and their churches closed.
The harlot's media will be flooded with horror stories of how Pentecostal Christian evangelists have victimized the poor. They promise them material prosperity in return for money, defrauding them of their pittance of welfare and Social Security funds. Lawmakers will make it a form of genocide to convert anyone to Christianity, especially a Jew.
Anyone who witnesses in public will be guilty of proselytizing, a hate crime punishable by fines and imprisonment. because of its historic condemnation of homosexuality and blame upon Judaism for the crucifixion of Christ, authentic Christianity will be universally regarded as the most hateful of all religions, while tolerance will be extended to every cult and perverted practice. Humanity will agree that Christianity should be outlawed. As the harlot's control solidifies and the anger of mankind is whipped to a frenzy against Christianity, it will become possible, as it was under Jewish communism, to imprison millions of Christians. As the church languishes, starving in the cold of the coming gulags, gone will be the romantic litany that God blesses those who bless Israel. Gone will be the delusion that a quick elevator ride called the rapture will deliver the church from persecution. With the Star of David flying over the world, the church, decimated and nearing extinction, will at last recognize the enemy who has taken off her smiling mask and turned with fury. All that will remain for Christians is hope that death or the coming of Christ will deliver them. Meanwhile, almost every Christian will have to live with the gnawing guilt that if only they had heeded Jesus' warnings and been suspicious of those he described as the synagogue of Satan, this unending nightmare could have been avoided. Most Christians, of course, had passionately supported the rise to power of those who are now their cruel oppressors. Most criticized as anti-Semitic those few voices who tried to warn them. Now the previous world is gone, impossible to be recovered. Gone are the megachurches and smooth-speaking televangelists they loved so well. Now, in an endless hell on earth, they can do nothing but repent and curse not only their own foolishness, but that of the generations of Christian leaders before them. They were supposed to be watchmen on the wall, yet they failed to utter even a hint of warning. Such a leader was Billy Graham. In a presidential tape recording of a private conversation between Graham and Richard Nixon, Graham said, "This Jewish stranglehold on the media has got to be broken, or this country's going down the drain." The president replied, "You believe that?" Graham replied, "Yes, sir." The president responded, "Oh, boy, so do I. I can't ever say that, but I believe it." Yet in 2002, when this conversation was made public, far from upholding his warning to the church and nation, Graham first denied remembering he ever said it, then later apologized to the rabbis of Cincinnati. He said his moment of rare truth-telling was unforgivable.
How long will Jewish dominion last? Revelation indicates that it may not end soon. In Revelation 17:9, St. John sees Babylon, during her coming glory period, sitting on seven heads or kings. Five have already passed, one is reigning, and one is yet to come. This succession of seven kings may stand for seven administrations of the harlot's rule, a period which could occupy more than a century.
Jesus was very realistic about Judaism's capacity to inflict a reign of terror. We have seen how Jewish revolutionaries could kill millions without remorse. Christ knew that the church age would begin with persecution by the Jews and end with it. Being led up to his own crucifixion at the hands of the Jews, Christ remarked about them, "If they have done such things while the tree is still green, what will they do when the tree is dry?"
With the crucifixion of Jesus came the spiritual drying of the Jewish nation. Christ said their house was now left unto them desolate. It is such a desolate house that now controls our media and makes enemies for America in the Mideast. But far, far worse is yet to come. After the harlot has subdued all nations, and perhaps seven kings of Israel have passed, she's ready for love. The prophet Daniel tells us an eighth king appears, called the Little Horn, speaking great things against God. Israel falls for this utterly charming yet ruthless Jew from Russia, called Gog, the chief prince of Mesech and Tubal. He's also called the profane prince of Israel. Like a spider luring her mate into her web, the Jewish nation makes a marriage covenant with this false Messiah called the Beast or Antichrist. This Russian Jew is portrayed in Revelation 17 as symbolically possessing seven heads and ten horns. These represent his influence over a confederation of nations of Europe. Mounting the beast, Babylon the Great proudly proclaims, "I sit as a queen and shall not see sorrow." Truly, there seems no one left who might resist the perpetual reign of Israel over the world.
Yet in her ascendancy, something totally unforeseen occurs. The beast rears on his haunches and throws the harlot to earth. He gores and burns her with his confederate nations. Suddenly, in a moment, the harlot plummets from the pinnacle of power to the pit of destruction. At last, the mother of harlots perishes, trodden underfoot by the feet and horns of the beast and his invading Gentile hordes.